This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, more reaction to last night's Republican presidential debate here in Wisconsin. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, many people were raised on the idea that getting a good college education would bring job security and upward economic mobility. And for some people, it does work out that way. But our next guest says there's a wider argument that education is the solution to economic inequality, and that's driven a lot of government policy. But he says things don't really work out that way, and that we've fallen prey to what he calls the education myth. And the myth isn't new. The idea that education can or even should be a one-way ticket to economic security and prosperity has been building, he writes, since the 1960s with support from both major political parties. He says the myth has done a lot of damage to people with college degrees who increasingly struggle with high debt and tough job markets, and to people without college degrees who often get left behind. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the importance of education? What role do you think it should play in society? As a government policy, do you think that investing in education is the best way to deal with things like economic inequality? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John Shelton is a professor and chair of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and vice president for higher education for the American Federation of Teachers, Wisconsin. His new book is called The Education Myth: How Human Capital Trumped Social Democracy. And we're talking about that book right now. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here, and I hope folks are staying cool out there.
Definitely. Now, you're clear in the book. You like education. You're a college professor. You are for it in many ways. But as a social policy, a public policy, talk about the rise of this education myth that you're worried about.
Yeah. I mean, I'm an educator professionally, as you mentioned. So it'd be pretty weird if I thought education was a bad thing. Education is a great thing, right? It opens doors for people. It's central in how we conceptualize democracy and has been in this nation since, you know, really pretty close to the nation's founding. The problem is that the way Americans have thought about education has changed. And as you noted, this started to change in the 1960s, particularly in the Johnson administration, when policymakers started by Democrats, actually, right? Johnson was a Democrat. Drew on these ideas from a school of economists called human capital. And the idea there was that investing in individual skills was the primary way that working people was why the economy had been prosperous, and how it was that working people should seek economic prosperity, right? And it ignored a lot of the realities for why American workers were so much more prosperous in the 50s and 60s, things like labor unions and progressive taxation and the legacy of the New Deal. But this education myth really took root starting in the 1960s, and more Democrats believed in it, like Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, all the way up through Barack Obama, and even to a certain extent, Joe Biden. And Republicans like George H.W. Bush, who said he wanted to be the education president, and of course, through No Child Left Behind under his son, there was a big political consensus that we don't need these other social interventions because they undercut the power of the wealthy, undercut the power of corporations, and make donors unhappy. And so all that was needed was to make it easier for workers to invest in their own education. And if they did that, they would be successful. And unfortunately, that ignores all of the things that actually happen in the labor markets, right? It's not just about a worker's individual skills. It's about whether the interest rates are high or not, right? And the Federal Reserve is trying to, induce lower economic productivity in order to reduce inflation. It's about where jobs are. Are there jobs in the city where you live? It doesn't matter what kind of education you have. If you're living in an inner city where there literally aren't any jobs, and also, like, how much power employers have. Is it easy for employers, as has increasingly been the case in the past 30 or 40 years in the U.S., for employers to break unions, right? Because that diminishes the power of workers in the labor market. And so I argue that the education myth has done a lot of damage, not because education's bad, but because it's allowed us as a political system to ignore all the other things that working people actually need to have economic security in the long term.
And you contrast this human capital notion with an idea represented by FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's what he called the Second Bill of Rights, saying that people had rights to jobs that pay for their needs, health care, child care. The list goes on. Can you talk about that vision that, if I'm reading you right, got left behind by the education myth?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to say something at the outset. It's really important that we don't romanticize some of the things that happened in the New Deal, as probably a lot of people know listening to this. But if you don't, I'll remind you, there were significant racial and gender inequalities woven into the New Deal because FDR and other Democrats had to accommodate white supremacist Democrats in the South who controlled a lot of congressional committees. So I don't want to romanticize this. But the key term here is social democracy, that coming out of the experience of the New Deal, or sorry, the Great Depression, and all of the efforts from working people across the United States, really since the beginning of the industrial era, to fight for labor rights and to fight for industrial democracy and to fight for healthcare and other things that that people need to have good lives, the New Deal and the FDR administration really privileged the idea that of social democracy, expanding the economic and social rights of everyday Americans. And the political system completely changed under FDR, right? Democrats became the majority party in the United States for like 40 years until the 70s and 80s, arguably later than that. And they did that because they premised the entire political system on these economic and social rights for everyday workers. And they were deeply popular. So you have the expansion of retirement and Medicare and Medicaid in the 1960s, these deeply popular programs that made people's lives more economically secure. And that's really what the premise of the New Deal. And as you mentioned, the Economic Bill of Rights, which is a speech that really kind of capped the FDR administration in 1944 and its call for social democracy. And the argument that FDR made, and I think this will probably resonate with a lot of people today, is how can you be free if you can't find a good paying job? How can you be free if you don't have healthcare? How can you be free if you don't have the right to recreation and the right to transportation? And yes, education. How can you be free if you can't have all of those things? And so many of those things, there are massive impediments in a free market, supposed free market economy for people to access those things. And so what the New Deal was all about was actualizing those things so that people would have the economic security to have better lives. That's really what was driving it.
Talking to John Shelton from UW-Green Bay about his new book, The Education Myth, How Human Capital Trumps Social Democracy. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, a big change here between that Economic Bill of Rights idea and what you say is the human capital, the education myth is, okay, if we have a bunch of people in low-paying jobs, that other model, the FDR model, might be to say, okay, how do we get the wages for those jobs up so they're more livable? The human capital model seems to be, how can we get people education so they can get out of those low-paying jobs and into higher-paying jobs? How does that end up affecting people without college degrees, ultimately?
Yeah, and let me add one other thing to that, Rob, and this is important. Under the New Deal, it wouldn't just be let's try to raise people's wages. It would be let's directly create jobs so that workers have access to good paying jobs. Right? One of the big things about one of the most important successes of the New Deal was through the Works Progress Administration, literally creating millions of jobs that put people to work. So you get to the 1960s and Lyndon Johnson, and it's not just Johnson, there's many people around him too, are really concerned about the growing realizations of the poverty that still existed in the United States, even in this massively more prosperous time of the 1960s, right? There's all these exposés about poverty, and this connects to race, of course, because civil rights protesters are demanding economic equality. And so the Johnson administration is inspired to do something about this. And there's a debate in the administration, right, about how to solve this. Should there be more efforts to like literally create jobs in places like Detroit and Watts in Los Angeles, where African Americans have very limited economic opportunities? Or should the resources be given to try and expand education for people in those areas? And unfortunately, in my view, those resources go toward education as not that I think education is bad, again, but as the means to try and help them overcome their supposed deficiencies in the labor market, instead of ensuring that there are good jobs available for them. And that's a really, really important choice. And I think the Johnson administration did it for a couple of reasons. One, because, you know, you have economists and other people who had succeeded in the kind of academic meritocracy saying that was the best approach, right? Give people the right education. But it's also easier to do that, right? You don't have to upset the political assumptions and power dynamics that exist in society if you are just telling people we're going to give them the education, right? And so, unfortunately, in my view, that then drives 50 years of policy in terms of how we're going to help people help people who have limited economic means, help them to gain better jobs and to gain economic security. And it's just impossible for that to work, right? And so when you hang everything on education, particularly, as you noted, the promise of college degrees, which becomes a much bigger part of this story, especially from the 90s on, when you have Clinton negotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement and saying we're going to reskill workers and pushing workers into college, and especially George W. Bush and Barack Obama pushing for college as the answer. What happens is you're telling all of those people, and in this country, something like 65% of Americans don't have college degrees. You're telling them we don't have anything for you. So I argue that has led to, especially for folks without college degrees, a lot of disaffection with the political system, and has led to some of the really sort of intense cynicism, I think, toward politics in our political system.
We're talking to John Shelton, professor of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay. His new book is called The Education Myth, How Human Capital Trumps Social Democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions for our guest. What is the purpose of education, of higher education? Should it be focused on job training and skills? Is that the best investment if we want to lift people out of poverty? Or do you like his notion of returning to FDR notions of social democracy? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with John Shelton, professor of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay. We're talking about his latest book. It's called The Education Myth, How Human Capital Trumped Social Democracy. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Laura is with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi. So I'm just calling really with my reaction, which is one of the things that you asked for. Thank you for taking my call. And I feel a little bit better after talking to the screener. She assured me that the guest is truly pro-academics or pro-education, because, at first listen, it doesn't really appear that way. It really sounds to me like what he's doing is advancing the kind of the fascist narrative that the right is really promulgating currently. I just hear them steadfastly being so pro-labor, not as we think of it in terms, politically, but pro, I think, as opposed to pro-education. And I really feel that the purpose for, getting an education is not to get a job. The purpose for getting an education is to get an education. So I agree with the guest on that account.
However, Laura, I gotcha. Thanks. You gave us a lot to talk about already there. John, a book called The Education Myth could be a very different book. And I think maybe that's what Laura was hearing off the bat.
Yeah. And trust me, this is not the first time I've gotten it. And Laura, appreciate you calling in and talking about that, because it's a really important observation, a really important question. I think one thing that might help is if you think about this in terms of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So for people listening to this, there's a psychologist named Abraham Maslow who talked about the things people needed to have good lives. And so if you think about it as a triangle, at the bottom is things like the having basic needs met, right? Like things like shelter, food, housing, all of those things that we absolutely need as human beings just to kind of function. And so what I'm saying is, what we've told people is, you don't get those things unless you figure out how to get the right skills through the education system, right? And what we need to do is guarantee all those things to people so that they have those basic things. And education should be something, absolutely, it's going to give you the skills to go and do different things. That's the whole that's one of the purposes of it. But it's also about training people in citizenship and training people how to you know, effectively be like, you know, humane people who can get along with each other and empower people to you know, have friendships and everything, you know, and all the things that we know make our lives good. But you can't require, you can't tie people's long-term economic security to whether or not they get the right education. And that's what I'm really saying here. I want everybody to have all the, a good job, housing, healthcare, all those things, and the kind of education system that really enables people to be their best selves. That's really what I'm talking about. I am a deep believer in education. And what I'm saying is the way we save education is by making sure people have all these things. Save public education, I should say.
Laura, thanks for the call. And Laura also touches on, I think, a fundamental difference of opinion on the role of education. Education as preparing us for our jobs of the future versus education as preparing us to be citizens in a participatory democracy. Can you talk about that contrast?
That's absolutely right. And she mentioned, you know, the, you know, kind of right wing politicians. I believe she used the term fascist. I won't use that, but right wing politicians and the way they're thinking about education. There's been a concerted effort. I'm a UW professor, right? Like I'm on the front lines of this. A concerted effort by the right in this country and in our state. That's why we got a budget cut in the UW system. To prevent us from talking about things that we know our students and the people of this state need to talk about, like race, gender, sexuality, and class. That's what this sort of effort that happened in the budget to deprive the UW system of funding to prevent us from being able to, you know, have resources for diversity, equity, inclusion is really all about. So these are the fundamental stakes of this. Do we have an education system that is actually open to everyone and open to the pursuit of truth? Or do we have one, which I think many people on the right would want, that actually censors us and doesn't allow us to talk about the things that we know people need to learn about in order to have good lives? So she is onto something unbelievably important, and the stakes of that could not be higher.
Talking to John Shelton about his new book, The Education Myth, How Human Capital Trumped Social Democracy. John, you've got a vision for what you would hope education would look like and for public policy to look like. How do you see a way to get there from where we are now?
I think absolutely. And to go back to the point I was just making about the stakes of these debates around our education system, you're seeing people across the political spectrum have to really think about what it is we want our education system to do. And, you know, what I think, what we think about as Americans, most of us agree on, is we want a democracy. Not only do we want a democracy, we want a multiracial democracy in which every person in this country is truly treated as an equal. And here's how we're going to get there. We're going to get there by making sure that every single person is treated with the dignity that they deserve, that they have access to economic security so that they can live lives without the fear of what's going to happen to them if they lose their job or somebody gets a health emergency. And the education system is going to help us get there, because what education can do at its best, public education, is teach people to be good citizens, empower them to challenge the world around them and to organize with all of the other people who they know in their neighborhood and at their workplace to build the kind of multiracial democracy that we all deserve in this country.
And John, some of your main, I think, criticism in the book is directed at Democratic leaders, as in the Democratic Party leaders over the decades, who embraced what you call the education myth and in some ways became a party of the educated and professionals, leaving, I think you make the case, working people behind, working people perceive the Democratic Party moving away from them. And you say they may have had good reason to feel that way.
I think that's absolutely right. And there's obviously a lot of examples I could use. I wrote a whole book about it. But maybe the quintessential example of this is Bill Clinton, who became president. He was the head of an organization called the Democratic Leadership Council, which was formed in the 1980s, essentially funded by donors, elite donors who wanted to move the Democratic Party away from its traditional focus on working people. And Clinton ran for presidency, of course, in 1992. And then when he became president, one of the first things he did was to extend George H.W. Bush's administration's negotiations for the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was incredibly controversial, NAFTA. Organized labor, environmentalists all pushed to not have that law or to have that trade deal passed because they knew it would cost lots of blue collar workers, people without college degrees, their jobs. And what the Clinton administration did is they basically, including Robert Reich, who's gone on to become a big progressive champion for working people since and said he was wrong about this, basically went around and said, it's okay, we know working people are going to lose their jobs, and that will lead to less economic security for them, but we're going to make it easier for them to retrain and they can go get another job. Well, not everybody wants to do that. People have pride in their jobs, right? And a lot of those people actually empirically didn't end up getting better jobs. They ended up with worse jobs and less secure jobs and jobs without unions. And so for a lot of working people, it didn't happen overnight, but you want to look at the kind of shift toward having at least some version, amount of people without college degrees shifting away from the Democratic Party and going to the Republican Party over those next 20 years. That was a seminal moment. It was a very important moment. And it was, I think it was disastrous. I think it was a very bad policy choice and bad political choice for Democrats, frankly.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Anytime, Rob. Good luck with the rest of the show.
That's John Shelton, professor and chair of Democracy and Justice Studies at UW Green Bay, vice president for higher education for the American Federation of Teachers, Wisconsin. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called The Education Myth, How Human Capital Trumped Social Democracy. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, special effects, supervillains, and some politics. We'll hear from the authors of a new book about political and social issues on the big screen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Plus, reserve a table for one. We'll get some encouragement to go out and do things on our own. Go solo, dinner at a restaurant, a movie, and more, and not feel weird doing it. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, a writer shares her story of learning about and meeting an aunt who had been institutionalized decades ago, and an expert from Disability Rights Wisconsin tells us how the state followed a national trend of institutionalizing children with disabilities before moving to try to keep families together. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll check out yesterday's Republican presidential debate in Milwaukee, and you could join in with your reactions. First, the way American families, the medical community, and society treat children with disabilities has changed over time. At one time, it was commonplace to simply send them away to institutions. There were a variety of reasons that families did that included the hope of getting them specialized care, but also so family members without disabilities could live without what they saw as a stigma of being attached to someone with disabilities. Our next guest chronicles some of that history as she tells the story of discovering her own aunt who had been institutionalized by her family decades earlier. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that happened in your family? Do you have an experience with someone who was institutionalized with a disability at a very early age? Did you learn later in life about a family member, maybe one you didn't even know about? What questions do you have about how that practice came to be? What has happened since then? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer Senior is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She won the 2022 Pulitzer Prize for Feature Writing and the 2022 National Magazine Award for Feature Writing. She wrote about her family's story for the September issue of the magazine. The article is titled, "The Ones We Sent Away. I Thought My Mother Was an Only Child. I Was Wrong." Jen, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to be here to talk about this. Thanks for having me.
When did you realize that your mom wasn't an only child, as you'd been raised to believe?
Yeah, I was 12. And it's a strange age to learn such a thing because, you know, you're on the cusp of kind of adulthood. So I had both kind of a child's disorientation where I thought, what? Huh? I've got another aunt? You know, my family is just effectively doubled in size because my father only had one sibling. And, you know, so it was sort of outrage. And also then an identification with my mother, thinking, oh, my God, that means my mother hasn't seen her own sister. That means there was a lot of trauma involved for my grandparents. Mm-hmm. They sent a child away. So, yeah, I was 12 when I learned that.
And you eventually started digging in to learn more about your aunt Adele. Can you share briefly the story, why she was sent away?
So at the time, and this is language we would never use today, the words that they used were she was profoundly retarded. What she was developmentally disabled and intellectually disabled, with no one at the time could identify what. We knew that the plates of her skull had closed prematurely, so she had microcephaly, and she wasn't meeting the traditional milestones that an infant might. What is interesting is that, not interesting, it's chilling. Once it was determined that my aunt was different, and for a full year, my grandmother suspected she was different, but the doctors all poo-pooed it. Once my grandmother was very bluntly told that my aunt was indeed different, and the way it happened is that a doctor very casually looked at my aunt and said, called her a microcephalic idiot, which again was a technical term back then. This was in textbooks, you know, in doctor's charts. My grandparents did this frantic circuit visiting all sorts of specialists in New York City, and they all, to a person, told my grandparents to send her away. And so she was sent away when she was 21 months, which is just, it sort of boggles the mind to think about that. I mean, you can't even really wrap your head around this. I mean, she was a baby, you know, she was a baby.
And this wasn't uncommon at the time you learned. This is what many people did. How widespread was this?
It was utterly widespread, much more common than not. It was extremely rare. You would have had to have withstood the intense pressure from the medical establishment. I mean, doctors were so authoritative, you know, so authoritative back then, and or you know, invested with so much authority, and there they were in their white coats with their granite faces, you know, wagging their fingers at my poor working class grandmother who had never gone to college. I mean, and she went to one after another who all said that it wasn't just best for my mother, but in Adele's best interest, that was my aunt's name, that she would really benefit from a state institution, that is where she would flourish. It's the only place where she would learn. And they didn't have much faith in her ability to learn, but to the extent that it was even possible, it could only be in that setting. This was sort of how it was done. I mean, there were no support structures back then. I mean, certainly schools weren't taking kids who were developmentally or intellectually different. There was no such thing. Nobody thought about neurodiversity with any kind of enlightened or open heart. I think that, you know, also there was no state funding for speech therapy and occupational therapy and physical therapy, all the things that you now get as a matter of course, generally for free. There was often a religious stigma attached to it. The thought was that, you know, maybe this was a punishment for your sins, or there was the idea that, ooh, this was in your genes, right? It was scribbled into your bad DNA, you know, so it was a source of shame. There are all kinds of taboos around this, rather than being part of the glorious spectrum of humanity, right?
And you looked into what life was like, maybe if your Aunt Adele in some of these institutions and so many others, and it became a national scandal. Can you tell us a little bit about the conditions that many of these kids given up faced?
Yes. So it so happens that my aunt was in the very institution that became synonymous with this scandal. My aunt was placed in an institution called Willowbrook. And in 1972, well, I should back up. In 1965, Robert F. Kennedy, who was a senator in New York at that time, he came in, looked at Willowbrook, and declared it a snake pit. So we already knew, based on Kennedy, that it was a really, you know, less than desirable place. But it wasn't until a young, unknown reporter named Geraldo Rivera, who came in unannounced with a camera crew. Excuse me, I've got something in my throat.
Sure.
Yeah, I feel like I've swallowed a hairball just in time for your show. Anyway, so let's try this one more time. So Geraldo comes in unannounced with his crew. They are, you know, and suddenly the footage is ghastly. It's like something out of a Renaissance depiction of hell. There are just wailing children and adults on the floor who are unclothed, rotting in their own diapers, in their own waste. They were not in school, quote unquote, at all. The fact that this place called itself a school was just laughable. It was risible. It was despicable. It was disgraceful. There was no stimulation at all. If an attendant so much as dropped a piece of paper on the floor, the people on the ward would fight for it because it could be crushed into a ball and played with. Each individual on the floor only had about 2.5 minutes to eat. And if you consider how many of them couldn't feed themselves, it's appalling. They were force-fed. And some of them also had probably had GI issues that, you know, were undiagnosed. I mean, the conditions were so terrible. So that really was the beginning. It generated a kind of political will to close these places down and to create day programs. California provided a better model for this. They were already doing this. Kids were staying at home and going during the day to much more humane, you know, institutions. But all over the country, these kinds of state institutions were, you know, happening. It wasn't just Willowbrook. Willowbrook just became the notorious one, but they were everywhere.
We're talking to Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic about a piece she's written for the magazine's September issue, looking at the history and personal experience of institutionalizing children with developmental disabilities in the U.S. We'll go back to Jennifer in a little bit and hear the story of when she met her aunt Adele for the first time. Now, I want to bring in a Wisconsin perspective with Phyllis Greenberger, supervising advocacy specialist at Disability Rights Wisconsin, focusing on children's issues. Phyllis, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Nice to hear your story, Jennifer.
And these things, Phyllis, were happening here in Wisconsin, and that's part of the origin story of Disability Rights Wisconsin. Can you tell us a little bit about institutionalizing children with disabilities in Wisconsin's history?
That's true. Unfortunately, Jennifer's story is not uncommon, and Wisconsin also was, like Jennifer said, the whole country was doing this, and that there was a thought by doctors that it was better for the individual, for their parents, for their siblings, and encourage people to use institutions, and that was pretty common in the late 40s and early 50s. Here, just like it was, and into the 50s, just like it was in other places, and Wisconsin's change and national change did come from that reporting that Jennifer was talking about with Geraldo Rivera.
And can you talk about that transition, Phyllis, from these institutions in Wisconsin, starting, I think, in the 70s, when we started to move away from these kind of institutions?
Yeah, so in the probably late 60s and into the 70s, we started to work on more community-based programming. I think a lot of that came from parents beginning to feel like their children should stay at home, and parent advocates were a big part of some of this change. After this report in 1975, the Protection Advocacy System for Individuals with Developmental Disabilities started in 1975, and that is our agency is part of that protection and advocacy system. And so there were also the Education for All Handicapped Children, which is now the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, was passed in 1975. Section 504 of the Rehab Act, which said you can't discriminate against people with disabilities, was in 1973. So there were a number of laws that started the change toward community-based programming. And then based on some of those laws, there was funding, as Jennifer had pointed out. Now you can get community-based funding for all these kinds of services that people could not get at that time.
And Phyllis, before we let you go, if someone is listening, they have a disability themselves or have a child with a disability, they're looking for resources. They're looking for advocacy. Where are good starting points for them?
So if it's for your child, a good starting point is your school or your county. Those are two places that you can get some information. If you're struggling with some advocacy needs, you can also contact Disability Rights Wisconsin. And our website is Disability Rights Wisconsin or disabilityrightswi.org to get more information. But schools and counties are a good place to get information. And people do still struggle with this. As much as we've moved away from it, people do struggle to get the services they need. We've had a real crisis in providers for people with disabilities. And so definitely reach out if you need some help.
Phyllis, thanks a lot for joining us. That's Phyllis Greenberger.
Thank you for having me.
That's Phyllis Greenberger with Disability Rights Wisconsin. We're talking about a once common practice of institutionalizing children with developmental disabilities. Jennifer Senior stays with us from the Atlantic. We're going to pick up her family story in just a minute and maybe hear from you with your experiences at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic about her new piece called The Ones We Sent Away. She shares the story of her aunt who was sent to an institution as a child. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Stephanie is with us in Appleton. Stephanie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about Stephanie?
So I live in Appleton, but I learned an adult now with my own children, but I learned probably my high school years upon talking with my mom and her two sisters, I learned of a brother that they had that I wasn't aware of. And turns out he was born in the early 1950s in Milwaukee, with known to have had Down syndrome, for sure. There are probably other medical things that weren't diagnosed at the time. But my grandparents were of stature in the community in the Milwaukee area. And so it was, for lack of a better word, an image thing and some other personal complications with not knowing how to provide best care, which I think Jennifer had mentioned earlier, too. People just didn't know what was best for individuals with disabilities at the time. So without the resources that they thought they could do the best for him, it was decided that he would be given up. They resigned their parental rights and he was institutionalized from the hospital. I actually was able to reconnect with him. In my 20s, not too long ago, and I was in the process of working with his amazing guardian who voluntarily took care of him. Her name is Christy Bleakey, and she's just an amazing human. And our story has a happy ending in some regards, but it was similar in that we didn't know of him, or most of us didn't know of him, and it wasn't really spoken of.
Stephanie, thank you so much for sharing that story. A lot of common ground with your story, Jennifer. And from there, can you take us to when you first met your aunt, Adele?
Yeah, God, I don't know whether it's depressing or affirming to hear how similar some of these stories are. But I met my aunt Adele the first time I was probably 28. It was in 1998. And I just sort of expressed an interest in meeting her. And my mother had gone such a long time without seeing her. She'd gone 40 whole years. I mean, you can imagine from her perspective, she was 6.5 years old. She's developed this relationship with her little sister, who, as far as she's concerned, is perfect. And at 21 months, this sister is mysteriously vanished, right? My mother is given this kind of half thought out explanation that my grandparents were trying as hard as they could. I'm sure they said that my aunt had gone to walking school. So for 40 years, my mother never saw her sister. It was a source of so much kind of torment and, you know, trauma, I think, for her. She had only seen her, she'd seen her right after her father died. So when she saw her with me when I was 28, it was her third time, and we really didn't bond. So it wasn't really until 2 years ago that I said, Mom, we've got to do this. She's still alive. And at this point, Adele was 70 years old. And that's when we really started visiting her in earnest.
Thanks a lot for that call, Stephanie. Mark is with us now in Bloomer. Mark, hello.
Hi there. Yeah, first of all, I'll say I totally disagree with this institutionalizing people, it's wrong. That being said, I understand the social pressure that would be on a family to do such an institutionalization. I remember the day when my mother, holding her most beautiful child, was told that she must have done something really horrible for God to have punished her with a child like that. And I remember my mother coming home from church sobbing because she was told my brother should never come to church because he was disruptive. Thanks be to God that the pastor said, no, you bring your child to the church. Things change, and yet they don't.
Mark,
we have so much work to do.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. And Jen, that speaks to the pressure that you mentioned on parents. We might wonder why they'd be put in this situation. Mark's story shares some of that.
Well, yes, and also what I said about this being religious punishment, right? Mm-hmm. That was a really common refrain. You must have done something to incur God's wrath. I mean, imagine, right? You've just had this child, this beautiful child, and really, in the eyes of a church, I mean, we're all made in God's image. We should all be loved, right? And yet this was the line? I mean, it's as he said, it's really shameful. It's horrifying.
Thanks for sharing that story, Mark. Jennifer, as you said, it took a while, but you and your mom started regularly visiting your Aunt Adele. And it ended up being a really, if I'm reading your piece right, a really good relationship. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No. Well, there are a couple of things that really stuck. Even when I visited her when I was 28, the similarities between her and my mom were really striking. My mother was going through this manic needle-pointing phase, and so was her sister. My mother was doing like the Chagall windows. She was doing these comically ambitious projects, and Adele was doing much simpler things, but I thought it was really interesting. My mother studied opera in college, and Adele could sing on key. So I knew about these similarities going in. So the weird thing is the first time I see her, you know, when she's 70, now 21 years have gone by, both her and my mom are wearing these bright red sweaters. Like they look, they're dressed identically, right? And they both are wearing these giant chunky beaded necklaces that they have both made because they're both now simultaneously going through these like beading stages. And I just stared going, what? Seriously? And then I found out even more funny or sort of amusing to me is that my mother, you know, I love her. Don't get in her way if you're trying to load the dishwasher. She's going to tell you that you're loading it wrong. She's got very firm points of view about how one loads a dishwasher. And it turns out that Adele, same thing. Like, heaven help you if you put a glass out of place, if anything is out of place, to the point that at their group home, one of the running jokes became people would slightly move things just like a quarter of an inch to the left just so that they could watch Adele silently go over and put it back to where it belonged. I mean, that's my mother. Like the two of them, I don't know what it is. I don't know what that is.
Jennifer, I want to take a minute to maybe just give a shout out to one of the brightest spots in the story, the people who are caretakers at the group home for your Aunt Adele. Amazing. Tell us just a bit about them.
Oh, my God. So Carmen and Juan Ayala, I mean, their names ought to be written in the sky. They are saints. I mean, so caretakers are underpaid, underappreciated, undersung. They are everything. They are not doing this for the money. They are not doing this for the glory. They are doing this because many of them, because they feel that they have to. And Carmen and Juan, were their house was just this, like, it just fills with joy. Juan in particular, like, was this kind of mirthful prankster who taught Adele how to salsa. They just, it was a house full of like in jokes and vaudeville pattern. Adele, who's the turkey head? Daddy's the turkey head. Just all of these wonderful, I mean, Carmen would wake up at 5 a.m, 5 days a week with my aunt just to, like, you know, put on the perfume that she liked, to do her hair exactly the way she wanted it. And my aunt is so fastidious, right? Was so fastidious that had to be exactly right. You couldn't get that wrong. To bought her all the clothes she wanted to have bought. I mean, just all of these things, right? So, yeah.
That's I like leave it there, Jen. Thank you so much for sharing your family story with us.
Thank you so much for having me on to share it.
That's Jennifer Senior with The Atlantic. We talked to her about her new piece on how she discovered a lost aunt, one she didn't know about, who had a disability and had been institutionalized as an infant. Coming up, look at the Republican debate. This is Central Time.